Welcome to the Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards. The Reimagining Podcast is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which includes the Baltimore Wisdom Project and the Chicago Wisdom Project. Our shared mission is to reimagine education and reimagine the world by enhancing the lives of youth and adults with holistic education, intercultural understanding, and anti-oppressive, liberationist thought leadership.
The teachings of Jesus Christ are so radical that they are apocalyptic. The values of the old world must be turned upside down. He did not merely want a more just world, he wanted a reimagined one. The question I would pose for Christians today is, what is the nature of this reimagined world? While it is possible that Jesus, like other zealots, advocated an armed rebellion and an earthly kingdom, there's also much evidence from his teachings that he advocated neither a worldly kingdom nor a holy transcendent one. That is, he promoted a more just order, a radically changed world, but seemed also to believe that we could arrive at it through means far different from his contemporaries. Jesus was part of the apocalyptic movement. Unlike Paul, he seemed not to believe that the end would arrive at some specific point in the coming days, but that it was already here if we can only undergo an interior transformation. This concept, called realized eschatology, represents a unique teaching that likely came from the historical Jesus. In breaking bread with the untouchables of his society, Jesus ushered in a new sacrifice. This is where the communion ritual comes from. It required no priest, at least until the church was Romanized. The story of Jesus remains incredibly influential today. The reclamation of the Jesus of history could teach us much about our world today, more than much of the teachings we find in the church. He was a poor man from a marginalized class, forced to sell his labor because of the policies of the empire. He challenged the empire, demanding that they deal honestly with the fact that they'd stolen land of his ancestors, and he challenged his own people, who struggled to retain their identity and to find meaning in the face of cultural imperialism. For Christians, seeing the historical Jesus in context should not hinder their experience of Jesus Christ. Rather, in understanding more deeply who Jesus likely was, the experience of Jesus Christ through the engagement of the believer in the world makes for a more alive, more meaningful, more authentic Christianity. In other words, don't look to find Jesus in the eyes of the pre-church or megachurch. Find him in the undocumented laborer standing by the side of the road waiting for work to feed his family. This man, like Jesus, is living on the edge and can see the injustice and apocalyptic nature of the day. As a national speaker, advocate, and MC, Julian J. Quest Deshazier has appeared on ABC, Fox, NPR, and Dr. Maya Angelou's Oprah and Friends radio program. J. Quest is also an Emmy Award-winning musician featured on the video Strange Fruit, a commemoration of the Billie Holiday song and a meditation on racial violence. The Chicago native and graduate of Morehouse College and the University of Chicago is also pastor of University Church, a sanctuary congregation for immigrants that also worked with Chicago's Southside community to raise a level one trauma center. Recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of 40 under 40 leaders in Chicago and by the Center for American Progress as one of the 10 faith leaders to watch in 2018, he serves as the inaugural chair of the Community Advisory Council for University of Chicago Medicine, as Associate Director of the Office of Experiential Education at McCormick Theological Seminary, and as a Leadership Greater Chicago Fellow. Julian is a regular contributor to On Scripture and Sojourners, where he is also a board member. Julian Deshazier, welcome to Reimagining.
My brother, it's good to be here.
So there's a few different kind of angles that I want to discuss with you. I want to start with, you know, and I want to like think really broadly about, you are a pastor and you have a ministry. And so like, I want to like dive in and discuss how you see your ministry in the community and what kind of work do you focus on in the community, and talk a little bit about that. So what are you engaged in these days?
Yeah, so I think about that at a lot of different levels. Like the first is, how do I see myself engaging with this particular community that has chosen this place called church and chosen to make their life a part of being a part of this place? And so I think about how I offer care to people. You know, right now I'm dealing with two major deaths in our congregation, so that when that happens, everything else gets swept aside so that I can go alongside them in a meaningful way. And so there's this care piece and creating structures and processes in place that help us just take care of each other as best as we can. That's one piece. And I think at the level at which you are asking it, this it's not unrelated to that. But then there's a sense in which we take this community now and become a we, and then go and try to join the larger we. The circle always gets larger for me in the work that I do as pastor. And so then it's about asking. I think for me, when I started 12 years ago, it was asking a very simple question, which was like, what are the most important conversations happening around us right now? Like, what are people talking about? What are people struggling with? What are people excited about? And I've always asked that question really at the beginning of each year on a regular interval, just to make sure that we're engaged with and doing the right thing. And so the answer to that question has changed across the years. When I first started, that question was around access to healthcare and having a level one trauma center on the South Side, which didn't exist. And so our church became really engaged with that movement and with those activists and wanted to help them however we could. And that answer soon after that merged into deep partnerships with Black Lives Matter. And then we had some work around immigration and sanctuary, and it became clear that that needed to be restarted again. And so our partnerships with those folks began to come alive again. We had been one of the first sanctuary congregations in the 80s, and starting that up again a few years ago was really important for us as well. So yeah, I mean, I would say that we're always trying to be engaged with and in partnership with those folks who are affected by some of the most important conversations and most important issues that are happening right now. We do a lot with affordable housing. We own two buildings in Woodlawn. So yeah, there's always, it feels like there's a lot going on, but it's always connected not to a sense of, hey, what do we feel like we just want to do, but what does it feel like is urgent enough to call us away from everything else to really tend to this right now?
And just so people listening understand, you're located in Hyde Park, right? Kind of right next to the University of Chicago, and on the south side of Chicago. And Woodlawn is the neighborhood where I happen to live, directly south of Hyde Park. And you know, I've been thinking a lot about the question of how, of what constitutes a neighbor, which feels to me like it's something that is, you know, they just converted an old school in Chicago, particularly in the south side. We have like this pattern of continually closing neighborhood schools. And we have an empty building near a home, which they've converted into a shelter for migrants. And there's a lot of sort of controversy about that. I really like the way you framed this thinking in terms of like these expanding circles of care, right? These expanding circles of what constitutes our community, right? And I'm curious where that comes from. I mean, you're like kind of in a highly intellectual environment near the university, and you have a lot of progressive values that are derived from that. And where do you draw your sense of community from in terms of your faith tradition? How does that work for you? And is that an important part of your, I mean, of course, a person can be a good and kind and caring neighbor without that faith tradition. I'm curious how that informs you.
I grew up in village. I grew up with this concept of always having, and it was mostly women who surrounded me and said, "You're not alone." They never said, like, "Hey, this is what you need to do. We're gonna make decisions for you or anything," but they always wanted me to know, like, "You're not alone in this. Like, your life is not lived alone or by yourself." And so I was very fortunate to have a strong village around me of folks who were caretakers and aunts and mothers, plural, I would say, and folks who really like invested in me and wanted my well-being to be understood as I was well, not because of what I did. I was well because of who I was with and who I brought with me, and that my identity was not as one who lived on an island, but as one who lived with. And that was always hard for me growing up because I didn't like group work, you know, like nobody likes that. Like the people don't do their part. People you depend on don't do their part. They're not a ton of responsible adults just walking around. It can be difficult sometimes to think of ourselves as doing life as group work, but it's something that was embedded in me from childhood. And then certainly once I went to Morehouse and other places, that really just framed it as like, you are not just you, you are part of community. And so I say all that because once I went into the church, it was that same ethos. It was like, we aren't just like, well, because we're us, or because there are 300 people here and now there are 350 next year. Now that, you know, like, that's not the only metric for success for us. In fact, there are several important, more important ones around how are we engaged and with the wider community around us. Like, a question that has always been really important to me philosophically, theologically, what have you, ethically even, you know, is like, what constitutes a healthy community? Yeah. What are the parts of a healthy community? What has to be there if a community is healthy? Do you need a good school? Do you need a church or a temple at all? Do you even need that at all? You know, and that answer has changed across the decades. But I've always been interested in that question. And I've always, I think, as a pastor, kind of biased in this, but kind of convinced that a good church can be part of a healthy community, can be generative in that work. Doesn't necessarily need to be central to it or leading everything. That, you know, we can talk about all that, but how can we as a congregation be a part of our imagination and the community around us, their imagination of what it means to be healthy? That is something that has always been pretty central to me, and thankfully pretty central for University Church as well. Like, those folks, I didn't have to come in there and teach them that. Like, they got that, and that's why we got along so well and we're able to do so many things.
Yeah, you know, I'm really interested in this idea that you touched on of thinking about, because to me, it feels fundamental, like one of the most intense challenges we have, like as a, not just as a community, but as a, and not even just as a society, but sort of like as a species, is whether or not we think of ourselves most fundamentally as in relationship or community on the one hand, versus being individuals in competition with one another on the other hand. You know what I mean? Like, right. I think that's like a huge question. And you framed it in terms of your experiences, you know, just growing up and at Morehouse, you referenced, and also in the church. But I feel like I want to dig into that a little bit more and point out that while it certainly is true in many contexts, it's been kind of, I think, fundamental to the role that the Black church in America has played, but it's not a given in every Christian church. You hear a lot of theology that's really highly focused on kind of individual salvation, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And you know what I mean? So I'd like you to maybe talk about that a little bit theologically and philosophically, how you see that. Do you draw from straight from the Gospels for that? Or do you feel like it is woven into the tradition of the Black experience in America? Like, how do you see that? That emergence of this kind of community, communal, relational ethos.
What I appreciate about this question is that it calls out how often I take for granted that the way that I think about the world and about Christianity is shared by a lot of people. Because at this point, for my own health, I'm just trying to hang out with folks who, you know, are, I'm trying to deal with folks who are seeing it in that way. So I spend so much time in that kind of space. But you're absolutely right. A lot of people have a lot of different interpretations and sort of imaginations of what religion and faith should be in relationship to wider communities that are not Christians like them, or just the other. You know, we're dealing with, I think, the fallout of that in our country right now, of really what a Christian, white Christian evangelical nationalism. That's a lot of adjectives there, but I think all of them need to be there, you know. The fallout of their imagination of the world and how different it is from mine and from millions of other people, including many Black people. And so I draw certainly from beginning with the text and the Bible, you know, in our tradition, where I see tons of examples of, I see Jesus creating community in nearly every moment of something that he's doing, all of these miracles, everything else. These are all moments where the community has been broken and he moves into that space and says, let's have it together. It's better if it's together. Or my favorite illustration is when in one version of the feeding of the 5,000, like the disciples come up to him and say, hey, this is all we have. And look at all these people. What should we do? Should we call this off? Should we, you know, like, what should we do next? And he looks at him and says, you feed them, like you do it. So he's always building this community that's not just community, but it's like empowering community. It's community where people have agency. It's a places where people have the same miracle working power within them to make themselves well. And so I draw from that, and that also makes clear connections to the Black tradition and the Black church tradition in particular, which does a lot of that same work in terms of saying, no, we need to live together. We need to take care of one another. It comes out of that African tradition of Ubuntu and living life together and understanding ourselves as living life together. And so that's just in my DNA in such a way that I do take it for granted sometimes. And anytime I watch the news or anything else, I'm reminded of how far apart Christians can be on this and how dangerous that difference can be as well because of the violence that can be created out of it. And so, but yeah, those, a lot of what I think comes out of reading the Bible, growing up inside of the Black church, or in particular, Black church structures that were a little bit more progressive in some things and conservative on other stuff, is that paradox exists as well. But mostly sure. Politically progressive and looking at like, hey, how are we going to take care of each other? How are we going to live life together?
Yeah. And I think that question, like, how are we going to take care of each other, is so fundamental. It feels like any reading I could do of like the synoptic gospels, for sure, whenever the question is posed literally or just like contextually about who's my neighbor, there's like always, the bias is always towards an expansion of the notion rather than a retraction of it, right? Exactly. And that's kind of what you're speaking to, right? It's always, no, that's always
that circle
bias,
always,
right?
Should be widening.
Yeah. Just
anytime
bigger,
we
bigger,
feel,
yeah.
It can be a criteria even for examining how well we're doing. If we feel our circle getting tighter, we are not as healthy as we can be.
That's right. So, that's right. That's right.
And yeah, so as we get older, as we have more experiences, as we engage in the world, just day to day, our circle should be widening. You know, maybe not in a way that's quantitative, like, oh, I met 3 new people today. One of them became my friend. Like, no. But your understanding, your observation of what you call the other and your relation to folks who you've always, and ideas that have always felt foreign or strange to you, all of that should change and dissolve. And as you become a part of this we.
And I think that notion you just described is so, it's connected to, and I love how kind of these sort of disparate concepts or apparently disparate notions of, or traditions of, on the one hand, the gospels, and the other hand, you made reference to Ubuntu, right? And they really kind of come together, I think, in a profound way. And it's almost like because of so many other influences that were sort of imposed upon the church, there were elements of the gospels that were less clear. Like, it required people who were coming together, bringing that tradition of Ubuntu to see more clearly that notion of relationship and community. And really, in some ways, it's a way to survive and thrive.
Right.
Because if you're living in a situation as people who are living under the conditions of Jim Crow or enslavement were living, the idea that we always have a bias towards inclusion and taking care rather than you're not part of our community.
Yeah.
That inclusion is a survival tactic and a way to flourish in the midst of difficulty. If there's always, no, your family. Even kin is considered a much more expansive and less kind of like mathematical, limited to blood relations kind of a way.
Yeah, exactly.
No, you know what I mean?
The bloodline is, we can't even, you almost throw that out the window when you're thinking about family, you know?
Like, right, right.
It's
right.
A part of it is both and, you know, it's, you got several big mamas in your life. You got several people who live down the block and can tell you what to do. They're not related to you, but that's uncle, that's auntie. You know what I'm saying? That's so. Yeah, those notions, and those notions saved me when a lot of those core relationships, or what we might call nuclear relationships, were either not there or had eroded. That I that's why I say I had mothers. You know?
Yeah. Right. That's right. Right. Because they
a wonderful
the act,
mother.
They engaged in the act of mothering.
That's right.
Them, right.
People who engage in that, you know, I had a wonderful mother. It's not a diss to my mother that you have two of them. It just means that you have several people in your life who do the act of mothering, and I'm all the better for it, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's something that I really try to think about and help create or help people understand if they want to create that in their life, that here's one place where you can do that.
You know, one of my daughters, my middle child, who's very sort of reflective, she once said to me, she's 9 years old now, this is in the last couple of years. So she said, how come we have so many aunties, but you and mommy don't have any sisters? You know, she was trying to navigate
that's it.
Yeah.
Oh no, it's the same thing. My 9-year-old is always like, so is this a uncle or is this just Mr. whoever, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, that everybody is, you know, anybody I introduce you to is somebody who's a part of your village and is here to take care of you. You know, like they're here to help you out in this journey. If you see them out there, you know, and hopefully I feel like I can feel that way about everybody in my life or their life, my kids. But you know, some folks are knuckleheads, but that's in any village. That should not destroy the idea that we still live together. It should help us to call out that exception and really hold accountability to that and say, no, that's not how this should be. You're gonna have to figure this out or you're not gonna be able to be here, you know? So
right. The hope would be that while we all have we all bring our own wounds and failings in many ways, that a community can sort of help draw out. And I think of this when I think of, you know, as an educator, right? And I think of it like, rather than think about what are your deficits, what gifts can you bring to the community? You know what I mean? It might just be one thing, it might be a small thing, but there's something.
Yes,
there,
that's, you know? Right. That's
so I wanted to talk a little more specifically about your work. You know, we just talk about a healthy community and more specifically, you've been really, you and your church together with other community partners have really been advocating for health care, like in a literal way, for folks on the south side of Chicago. So talk a little bit more about your work and engaging the university with that and say a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So I'm essentially, it's like, how do you have a healthy community without healthy people? You know, and in so many imaginations of healthy community, they really don't regard that people need to be healthy to be part of it. A lot of folks, in particular, politicians, developers, what have you, might say like, oh, we just need more buildings. We need more businesses. We need economic growth and development. That's the University of Chicago's language. Like they're constant with that, right? Like we just need to, it becomes this language of empire, of like of dominion. We need to take over all of this and then convert it into good because we're good. You know, some dangerous assumptions that never say out loud like, oh yeah, and we need people to be healthy to be able to participate in this. And that's what happens when you have a empire-based capitalist setup, whether it's at your university that runs the South Side or it's in your hospital systems or anything else, like at your city halls, what have you. Like folks don't think about healthy people because they think people are replaceable. And some of them think people not people, you know? And so we really felt very strongly like to be able to sit at those tables because we had access and relationships, what have you, but to be a voice at that table that wasn't just saying, okay, well, how can we help with your economic development? There are tons of folks who are brilliant with that. But really for us to say, how can we make sure that the people who live here now are able to help build this and participate it and experience all the flourishing that y'all at this table are planning? How can we make sure that these folks are healthy and not dying 20 and 30 years younger than they should because of chronic conditions, which are treatable decades in advance? So the more we began to say that at that philosophical level, right? Like we began to just look at, okay, what is the system and structure in place that's keeping people healthy? And beyond the trauma centers, it was an obvious moral flaw of Southside Power, the city of Chicago, that didn't exist already. And we just kind of named that, worked for it, and thankfully and got it.
And just so people listening understand, so there was the university invested a great deal into all this stuff for their hospitals without a trauma center. And it was requiring people to travel fairly long distances, correct? If there was, you know, say they had a traumatic injury, right?
That's right. So if you had a real quick, what's the quickest I can do this? If you have to go further than like 15 minutes or 5 miles, I think the research showed that your chances of dying increase significantly. And so if you don't have a level one trauma center, level one is just a designation that means that there's more surgeons and equipment for the higher level injuries, gunshots, stab wounds, you know, burn victims, fall victims mm-hmm. from certain heights, you know.
A kid runs out in the street and gets hit by a bus, right? Most trauma injuries
yeah. are car related yeah. accidents and such yeah. like they're not gunshot. And so mm-hmm. that you have folks in places where those people can go, where they can recover. And so if you don't have that on the South side, I mean, of course the life expectancy is going to go down. And so being able to create and make sure, advocate and fight for that to exist and eventually to push the University of Chicago to create a level one trauma center was a big victory, but it was also like obvious, you know, like of course we need that. I think the questions that we're asking now are around like, well, what other kinds of systems and structures need to be in place to ensure that people have access to a primary care physician and aren't using the ER like their once a year doctor visit? How can we make sure that they're making use of other local hospitals and federally qualified health centers and clinics and other space? Like everybody wants to go to the University of Chicago. And it's like, well, some places you actually better if you go to St. Bernard. You actually right. should go to Jackson Park to go do this. You know, it's going to be quicker. It's going to be cheaper. It's going to, you know, you'll have easier follow-up. It's closer to you, all of that. And so we're really working hard on that access question and that equity question to make sure that folks who are struggling with asthma and chronic disease and all of that stuff have the access to that treatment and know that if you can't get there, then we need to figure out a way to get you there, you know, whether it's paying for transportation or anything else. And so what exists now and is still really in its infancy, just in its second year, is the Southside Health Collaboration Organization, which is a collaboration between all of the hospitals and the clinics and FQHCs on the South side that are working together to try to figure out, okay, how can we share records? How can we pay for people to get to their appointment? How can we hire community health workers to call and remind folks? How can we pay doctors to go out and visit people at their homes? So just really trying to make sure that people are healthy enough to even think about, okay, well, what does it mean to have a Black business out on this corner? Or how can we advocate and fight for that? Sometimes even the ability to reflect or develop is a sign of privilege that a lot of people who aren't healthy don't have. And we have people in our lives who aren't healthy enough to think about, oh, how do I change my life and make it better? You know, it's like every time I walk, my knee hurts. I can't think about that. And so I think it operates like that at the individual level and at the macro community level as well. Like, if we can make people healthy, I promise you that they have enough wisdom to heal themselves. They will need no white saviors or anybody else. They can do this, but they need to be healthy. And so mm-hmm. can we use our power and privilege to do that for them, to create health?
Yeah. In a lot of ways, the trauma center is just the beginning, right? And it's beginning in a sense, like in a practical sense, in terms of like, you know, we're just dealing with like traumatic injuries, but also it's a beginning in the sense that like, let's just establish if we can that everybody's life matters, right? Everybody's health matters, and that we care about each other as a whole community, as a whole city, right? If we can establish that as a starting point, rather than thinking about all these other economic development and questions about profitability and money and things like that. If we could just begin with that value that everybody's life matters, everybody's health matters, we care about each other, then there's a lot of other details to sort out for sure. But that's right. I think, a good starting point. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll return.
Reimagining is a place for people who believe that the stories of the modern world no longer sustain us, bringing us to the brink of catastrophe, ecologically, economically, spiritually. Our troubles cannot be solved merely through technology or even politics. Rather, we need to reimagine what it means to be human. We seek new stories, new poetics, new ideas, and we put our ideas and stories into action. This work requires the wisdom of those at the margins and by those with the courage to imagine a new world.
I'm joined today by Reverend Julian DeShazier, and we're talking about community and the role of his church and the church more broadly in building safe, healthy, flourishing community and what that really means. So I wanted to like expand the question and think maybe more broadly, because we've talked about what some of your influences are and what for the work that you've done in the community. Certainly the church, capital C, the church is a kind of rapidly evolving institution and changing, and its role in the world has changed immeasurably over the last 20, 30, 40 years, right? Certainly in our lifetime. What do you see the future of the role of the church and of ministry in the world? How do you see that going?
I think probably the biggest thing, you could probably guess that I would say this because of my emphasis on community and life together and doing things together and taking care of each other, but just like the church is so bad at collaborating, so bad at every level we described earlier, every level of the we, whether it's just within the church, people just can't, they kind of show up and they say, oh, it's so professionalized. Ministry has become that people just kind of show up, sit in a pew. They look, okay, there's the expert up there. Let him, usually him, tell me what to do. And we'll make it that. That's not community. That's not community. We got to do better at that. We got to be better collaborators within church space in terms of saying, hey, no, we believe in a priesthood of all believers. You know, a lot of is language that my tradition uses and say, you know, everybody's got something to offer here. So let's make space and let's create processes and distribute our resources in a way that acknowledge that everybody's going to pitch in on this, you know, and not just give everything to the pastor and say, hey, good luck with that. You know, we'll be evaluating you at the end of the year. So like better collaboration inside of that space, but also like better the church itself being a better collaborator with community partners. I talk about partners a lot because it's a counterweight to what happens a lot inside of churches where they say like, oh, we want to end homelessness. So we're going to create a homeless ministry. And now we're doing it. And now we're starting from zero. And we're another drop in the bucket of many other organizations that are working on homelessness. And for me, I would just look at that and be like, why are we wasting our energy like that? Like if we want to have an impact on, in our case, immigration law, or taking care of folks who are coming into the community, then the question was like, all right, well, who's doing this work already? And how can we partner with them? How can we add to their resources, whether human or financial or otherwise? Like, how can we make them stronger? Because they're the leaders on this work. They're the folks most affected. That was the same thing with like Black Lives Matter when there was so much tension between a newer generation of activists and sort of the old guard of the Black church. Famous story of at the Laquan McDonald rally on Thanksgiving or Black Friday, and how activists and Jesse Jackson got at it. You know, it's very, very illustrative of a tension that exists between capital C church and an emerging movement of folks who are like, we know how to do this. We got this. We appreciate you, but you're not living what we live in, you know? So like, we need to take the lead on this. And so I've tried to, as someone sort of existing because of my age, but also just being in hip hop and all of that, like having more, leaning more towards, or leaning more outside of the doors of the church and more towards folks who are in the streets and being affected by things. When I come into the church and now I'm pastoring, I'm like, well, let's call them. Let's let them lead us. Let's make ourselves willing to be led by people. That's not always something that I think churches are thinking about, and it's really to our detriment. And I think when you look at all that data in Pew and all these other folks about people are nuns, people are leaving the church, some of it is just like, it's as simple as, well, I don't think you care about me. You know, like, I think you want to do it for me, but I don't think you want to ever allow or empower me to do it. And I don't think you ever want to equip me to do it for myself. I think that I'm trying to practice, and we're trying to practice at University Church, a way of doing church that hopefully could be the future for a lot of other people. You know, we don't practice it to say, oh, it's a model, let's write a book about it and you copy us. But to say, like, we're going to give people agency. We're going to collaborate with folks. We're going to try to be humble in our approach to relationship and regard people as our equals when we do this work. So that's one piece of it, that one place where I really want to see us get better immediately, because the better we can collaborate, the more power can come together, the more we can use that power to try to create the structures and systems that we need in the world around us. And so that is very urgent. Now, there's other stuff around, you know, bad theologies out here and ways in which people are excluded and all of that. that needs to be taken care of as well. There needs to be a more expansive understanding of ways of gender, of sexuality, of all of that kind of stuff. You know, we're not where we need to be yet as the church, you know? And so I hope that the future will include that as well. But sometimes it's just like, if you just come in with a humble attitude and just like shut up and just listen to them, you'll learn something, you know?
Yeah.
And you'll get something done and be a part of being something, of getting something done without ever being in front of the microphone, without ever needing to take over the press conference and all of that. And so that's something that I'm hoping will happen. I think another thing is like the same way that higher education is now beginning to move towards emphasizing communities of practice, where like the students actually have wisdom, and there should be some moments maybe in this curriculum where the students are sharing their wisdom, not just towards some test or to prove their knowledge, but to really like flatten that whole master-student dynamic and the power involved in that. I'm seeing that a lot because I'm at McCormick with the field studies program, and just in a lot of different spaces on the campus at the University of Chicago, I'm seeing a lot more of these communities of practice that are saying like, well, what do you have to share even as a student that might help teach your students, like your peers, you know? I think that ministry can learn a lot from that.
Yeah.
And I think that it recognizes that the pastor might be the resident theologian, but they are not the only theologian. And I try to say a lot, even in a sermon, like, here's what I think about this. Here's the scripture, though. Here's, you know, like, go check it out. Like, go, what do you think about it? Or to end every sermon with silence so that people can, where I ask them, okay, well, now you, what are you hearing now? You know, like, what's going on? Because I can benefit from that, and your neighbor can benefit from that wisdom that you're getting right now. And so creating a kind of community of practice, I think, could also be a part of the future of ministry. And it's really already there. It's in the text. It's in the tradition already, recognizing that people have power, and that, you know, you're not just like a superhero if you hear a call from God or whatever, like to demystify that whole thing and understand that, like, everybody has wisdom. Everybody has spirit within them. And how do we provide opportunities for them to share in a way that's not too overwhelming? And how do we change our structures to accommodate for the wisdom of all of us and not just hear your wisdom for an hour from the pulpit?
I think you're drawing from concepts in kind of educational, pedagogical concepts. Like, it's very like Frarian, this notion of what are the power relationships that I'm reinforcing, not just in my ideas, right? So in your case, like, you're talking about like, yeah, we have to, like, for sure fix some bad theology, right? That's a worthwhile thing, but it can't just be fixing the theology. It's like, what's the praxis then? Like, what's happening in terms of like the kinds of relationships that are occurring? Like, it's one thing if you are critiquing the power structures outside of the walls of your church, right? I think that a young person entering into that space who will question everything and won't necessarily assume that that's the way things ought to be will not take you seriously if they don't see the power relationships within the walls of the church changing.
Absolutely.
You know what I'm saying? So like,
absolutely.
So like thinking about this, I'm curious, you know, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to touch on this. So, you know, you're from a younger generation, from a lot of preachers out here. And you have a background, not just in ministry and in theology, but also in hip hop. You're an artist as well. I'm curious about, you brought up the idea of engaging young people. So I'm curious about ways that you think, like, I'm curious about Sunday, you know, like,
yeah.
We talk about everything but Sunday pretty much, right? So,
right?
And Sunday's still a thing, right? I think a lot of young people will be into everything that you said today, except maybe they might not want to sit through church on Sunday. You know what I mean?
Because
that may not be because of what you're doing or saying, but it might be because of the perception they have about what normally happens on Sunday. And they don't want to hear about God. They don't want to hear about Jesus. They don't want to hear about that stuff, right? They want to hear about, what are you doing? So, but I'm just kind of curious about, not even so much about the theology part or the activism part, but just What can you do to change what it looks like inside your community? And I mean, you know, in the smaller sense of like your church community, like to be more inviting to young people.
I think for us, you and I both know this because we were young once. I think we still are, but you know, anyway.
Relatively.
Yeah, relatively. To who we talking about, we old, you know, but.
Yeah.
But like people show up where they feel seen. People show up where they feel respected and affirmed, and like their humanity and the questions that they're holding and wrestling with, maybe even are going to be honored, are going to be taken seriously, and where they're going to be honored and taken seriously. And once you have that kind of sense, then yeah, let's talk about God. Let's talk about Jesus. You got some idea about something in the scripture. Oh, it really means this. You thought it meant like, then we can do all of the gymnastics around theology. But first and foremost, like, if I don't trust you and if I don't feel like I'm going to be safe in this space, what does it matter? What does it matter? And more people are saying that as opposed to maybe 50 years ago when people said, look, I work all day. I'm surrounded by white folks who hate me. So I'm coming to church. I really don't care what's going on here. I just need to be here. That's beginning to shift. There are now more places and communities and spaces of care so that people can say, you know what? I actually don't need this right now. I can go to brunch with my girls. You know what I'm saying? Like, we can, and we will center ourselves and we will take care of ourselves. We can go to the Beyonce concert. We have spaces we can go now. And so churches have to not take it for granted that like, oh, people want this or they need this or something. Like, no, they actually can get care outside of the church, which is a good thing, which is a good thing. That's a sign of a healthy community, I think. But it does mean that a lot of places got to really rethink like what Sunday looks like and feels like and how long it is one thing, you know, just at a practical level. Like nobody wants to hear you talk for an hour, no matter how good you are, you know? And so like that way of listening and participating now is done. It's done. And we're still having a hard time adjusting to that. Or even the structure of our services. It's funny, I was just saying this to some folks who helped me design worship at University Church and was just saying like, y'all know we don't have to have a sermon like in this space, and it doesn't have to be 20 minutes, and it doesn't have, like we can do whatever we feel like this community needs or the people who we want to offer care to and spiritual direction and formation. Like, let's think about them. Let's talk to them. Let's ask them, like, how could we shift this to make it something that you would want to be a part of? And so deeper listening in ways that, what does all this boil down to? Humility. The ability to say that, hey, the way that we have done it does not have to be the way that we always do it. What I know now is not what I will always know. Who I am now is not who I will always be. So let me look around me and get wisdom from others, insight from others, practices from others, creativity from others who might be within this space or might be people we want to get to know better. And let me learn from them. That has got to be the future, you know, and it means risk and it means loss. Let's get down to it, right? Like it means a lot of loss and death of old ways, of old thinking. And are any of us, churches included, really equipped or have we been given the tools in our Western society to really manage death and loss? Not really. So
there's so many parallels to so many of our institutions. And I think about the work that I've done in education and how we fall back on the way we've done it so much, like the way we structure a classroom or a school. We do it in such a way because that's the way we've been doing it. We might make modification or reforms, but they always reference the previous way of having done them. So those changes sometimes aren't as radical as they need to be. And I think about what you said, I really, in the same way that I've suggested that a classroom is a microcosm or a metaphor for the world, I think in some ways it's the same with a church, insofar as a church is a context to express our most deeply held values about the world, right? So it's an opportunity to, in a safe environment, a sanctuary, right, to express those values with each other, because it's hard to go out in the world that doesn't always share those values, you know? Right. So a church, I think, at its best, can be a way to practice those values with one another in an environment in which it's going to be okay. And that we can at least assume a level of care that people have for each other.
That's right.
You know, we're almost out of time here, but I just wanted to give you one more chance. If you could pick one thing that you think somebody who's entering into the ministry today, what do they need to learn? What do you think our seminaries, our institutions of higher learning, what do you think we have not been doing that people need to get now that you've been in it for a minute, for over a decade of being a pastor in a church? What was it? If you could go back, choose something in your training, in your education that you could feel like would better prepare you for this work, what would it be?
I said this the other day to a seminary, that if we were smart, we wouldn't just focus on training professional ministers. We would focus on training congregations to be communities as well. Mm. Like, because we spend so much energy and time and resources on one person, it also plays into this myth that once that person goes into a community, that they're going to fix it, that they're going to lead it, that they're going to be the one in charge. And there's not much good theology behind that. There's some good reasons for it practically, but I mean, we should be training communities. We should be training in much wider circles than we are right now, where we're training one person to go out to the people. Again, I get why that happens, but often those people go into communities that are thinking and practicing in a way that's so different from them that we spend our first 5 years just trying to undo that, you know?
Right.
And you know how theory of change, whether it's in education or any other institution, works. Like, change takes years to happen, but folks aren't staying in those pulpits long enough for that change to actually happen, which means that we're stuck. We're staying here. So we're going to have to look at a new way of training in ways that acknowledge, you know, the wider community understanding and bring them into the classroom as well. Or take the learning of the classroom out into the congregation.
Yeah, no, I love that. That's really, really beautiful. And really beautiful in the sense that it's so radical and so different from the way we think about it. Julian, thank you so much for joining us, for reimagining our world, the church, your ministry, our lives. And thank you for joining me today on Reimagining.
Such an honor.
The Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated. Original music by Cosmos Ray. Sound engineering by Jim Qualick. Thank you for listening and for reimagining with us.